Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2017, and you're listening to episode 46 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Arthur W. Hunt III, who is professor of communications at the University of Tennessee, Martin. He is the author of The Vanishing Word and Technopolis, and his writings have appeared in the Christian Research Journal, Touchstone, Salvo, and Modern Age. In the volume 40, number 3 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Art has written a feature viewpoint article called In Search of the Sacred, Evangelicals on a Quest and Why It Matters. Our viewpoint articles are op-ed pieces on topics by which not all evangelicals and Christians would agree, but we hope that after interacting with these various different viewpoints that you would be able to consider what the author has said. So, Art, it's good to have you on.
It is my pleasure.
Well, you mentioned in your article that young Christians are like yearning for mystery and meaning in a world that, and, you know, the current state of many evangelical churches isn't really focused on addressing those kinds of issues. They're very, a lot of the services are very, you know, mimicking pop culture. And so you quote philosopher Charles Taylor in his book, Secular Age, as he asks this question, why is it virtually impossible not to believe in God in, say, 1500 in our Western society, while in 2000, many of us find this not only easy, but even inescapable. So can you kind of unpack that for us?
Well, Taylor's book, A Secular Age, has generated quite a bit of discussion. If we could sort of sum it up, which is not easy to do, it's a very long book, but basically he's saying that our current age not only makes unbelief possible or acceptable, but it also has a way of forming us, molding us into practical atheists. For five centuries, we have become increasingly more secular. Back before, say, 1500, and he gives that date, the Christian West had a consensus, you might say, that the world and everything in it was a part of a harmonious whole ordered by God and filled with meaning. In other words, everyone believed that all things pointed to God. But now the West has arrived at a place of, we might even say, suspending the question of whether or not God exists. I mean, you rarely hear public statements that God has authority over us, has authority over the creation or human flourishing. So our faith has been marginalized to a matter of personal opinion. And this means, at least in the public square, that the West functions as if atheism is metaphysically true. But before 1500, Taylor argues, pre-modern Christians lived in a world of spirits and demons and moral forces, but this is no longer the case. And so through a series of what we might call unfortunate events, including changes of thinking as with the Enlightenment, it has led us to a different place. As John Lennon put it in his song, there is no heaven, there is no hell below us, above us only sky. And so Taylor refers to this kind of sentiment as a kind of disenchantment.
You know, you've also written articles about media and technology for us in the past, and you actually wrote an article for us on communication theorist Marshall McLuhan. If people don't know who he is, his most famous quote is, "The medium is the message." And he converted to Roman Catholicism when he was a young man, and he has this quote as well, "Especially hateful and devilish and inhuman about the conditions and strains of modern industrial society is not only Protestant in origin, but they're boasts to have originated. And to me, that seems a pretty harsh statement about Protestantism. Do you think he's correct in making that statement?
Well, it is a harsh statement, but I do think McLuhan felt it deeply. Let me give you some context to this quotation. His criticism was made to his mother in a personal letter when he was at graduate school. And he was reflecting upon, I suppose, his disgust of what he thought about the Industrial Revolution and what it had done to Europe and North America. Let me backtrack here just a little bit, because I think it's important to remember that the Industrial Revolution destroyed a lot of different things. It destroyed the old agrarian way of life. It uprooted masses of people so that they had to leave their homes to work in the cities. It changed family life because husbands had to leave their homes to work in the factories. It recast relationships in economic terms as opposed to familial or civic ones. And this was very radical. Are we to blame Protestants for this? Well, I don't think that we can say Martin Luther or John Calvin were preaching wealth accumulation from their pulpits. But Max Weber's argument that second and third generation Protestants put their blessings on specialized labor, which was one of the underlying bases of industrialism, does have some merit. There's even been some recent scholarship on this. For example, Brad Gregory, in his book, The Unintended Reformation, has reasserted the Weber thesis, sort of brought it up to date. Gregory asserts that the argument that the reformers gave birth to scientism, radical pluralism, liberal democracy, skepticism, modern consumerist capitalism, materialism by default, and ultimately, as Taylor even says, the disenchantment of the world, can we put all the blame on the reformers for this? Well, I don't think we can put all the blame on the reformers, especially the early reformers like Luther and Calvin, who were essentially medievalists. But I think we can say that modern science and the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, occurred when Protestants were the primary custodians of modern Western culture. And so by the time we get to the 20th century, Protestants, who still retained a commitment to the scriptures, looked up and looked around, and they said, what the heck is going on here? And so if we look back at the 20th century and we look at, say, the fundamentalist movement of the 20th century in America, it was an attempt to rein in the wiles of modernity. But what these good-intentioned people didn't understand was that progress with a capital P, was a runaway train. And so now here we are. To say, as Michael Douglas did in the movie Wall Street, greed is right, greed works, well, that has a materialistic kind of bias. It also has a utilitarian bias. We might even say it has a disenchanted kind of bias. And while many Christians would not agree with that, there's something about our age that does agree with it. But that kind of talk, greed is right, greed works, really has thrown God out of the picture. And so I think that's what McLuhan was getting at. You got to remember that McLuhan began his career by studying modern advertising, which we might define as the art of getting us to buy all the things we really don't need, or the art of materialistic desire. So this was where McLuhan was coming from, and he was a committed Roman Catholic.
But I think that the people, when you talk about the early reformers like Calvin and Luther, I mean, their concerns, well, and Calvin was involved in government, but their concerns were primarily theological in nature. It just is that over the centuries, many centuries, we find ourselves here. But I don't know, can we really say that it's the roots of Protestantism?
You know, I don't think we can point our fingers at Luther or Calvin and their theology. I don't think there's anything necessarily in our Protestant theology that would dictate us not having a critical eye toward modernity. In fact, many Protestants do. I do. However, I think secularization happened over a long, slow period of time, and to some extent, and this is Weber's thesis, is that there were opportunities when more could have been done to intervene into what secularization has become, and those opportunities were lost. And so now here we are.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Art Hunt, and in the volume 40, number 3 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Art has written a viewpoint article called In Search of the Sacred, Evangelicals on a Quest and Why It Matters. To read his article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. I want to talk to you a little bit about, you mentioned C.S. Lewis in your article, and you write that he believed that we were on the cusp of something never practiced before in history in our existence, and that's the transforming of the human species by the new conditioners. Can you describe who the new conditioners are, what he meant by that?
Yeah, well, that was from The Abolition of Man that he used that phrase. Both Charles Taylor and C.S. Lewis would probably agree with each other that established unbelief, what we might call our disenchanted secularity, did not begin with industrialism in the 19th century, or even in the Enlightenment in the 18th century. It actually began with something called nominalism in the 14th century. That's the idea that objects have no intrinsic meaning except for the meaning that has been assigned to them. Nominalism says meaning is not derived from God's created order, but is found in the mind. And both Taylor and Lewis knew that if we find meaning only in the mind, that was a very dangerous thing, because once we locate meaning in the mind, we become susceptible to those who would manipulate our minds for our towards their own selfish ends. So if you think for a moment about Adolf Hitler and his propaganda machine and what he was trying to do, change the way people think so that he could get them to follow him. Or if you think about Lewis's third book in his space trilogy, That Hideous Strength, and what he's doing in that book, or even The Abolition of Man, from which that quote is derived, the conditioners, it anticipates a political order that will seek to control us through what Lewis calls an irresistible scientific technique. Can I break down that word just a little bit? Irresistible scientific technique. First of all, Lewis, back in 1947, said that this would be irresistible. In other words, something so persuasive that everybody wants to buy into it. Second, scientific. I mean, who wants to argue with science? Not too long ago, I watched again that movie with Blackjack Nacho Libre. Have you seen that film?
Yes.
There's this character.
About the wrestling.
Yeah.
I enjoy that.
There's character in there who he's asked if he believes in God by Nacho, and he says, "No, I don't believe in God. I believe in science." I don't know if you remember that moment in the movie, but I think that sums up a lot of our own thinking. And then Lewis said that it was an irresistible scientific technique. It's a technique. Modern social engineering is a technique. In other words, by technique I mean that it has proven to save us time and money. It will make us better in the end, whatever that is. This is not too different from what French theologian Jacques Ellul said, that in modern secular cultures, that technique or technological know-how would replace moral discourse in the public arena and ultimately would contribute to the dehumanization of society. Now, in 1947, when Lewis wrote The Abolition of Man, he was concerned, when he used the word new conditioners, he was concerned with things like mass media and contraception and genetic engineering. And while these techniques are still with us, there are other kinds of what we might call irresistibles that threaten us today, many of which you discuss on your program. The redefining of marriage, transgenderism, transhumanism, these, Melanie, are the new conditioners.
I do want to recommend to people that for further thought, they do read something by Jacques Ellul. I got one of his books recently when I was doing some work on media ecology, and it was fascinating. One of the main focuses of your article, obviously it's in the title, is sacred or having a sacramental outlook. So can you describe for our listeners what you mean by a sacramental outlook?
Well, since the beginning of Christianity, and really for more than 1,000 years, there has been a common conviction that all matter, all nature, is mysteriously and metaphysically anchored in God. And to use Taylor's frame again, the world was enchanted because it was believed to be anchored in God. Hans Boersma, who holds the J.I. Packard Chair of Theology at Regent College, says in his book, which I recommend, Heavenly Participation, I'm going to quote him here, that the patristic and medieval mind readily recognized that the heavenly reality of the Word of God constituted an eternal mystery, and that observable appearances of creation pointed to and participated in this mystery. Of course, any theist position assumes a relationship between God and this world, but by sacramental ontology, we're talking about insisting that not only does the created world point to God as its source, but it also subsists or participates in God, or as Boersma would say, our connection with God is participatory, or a real connection. It's not just external or a nominal connection. So by a sacramental outlook, we're talking about a belief that physical matter is not just merely matter, but it's connected to something greater than itself. And this is found in the teachings of early Christian theologians, and it has biblical warrant. I mean, the Apostle Paul wrote to the Christians at Colossae saying that in Christ all things were created through him and for him, and that he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And the Apostle Paul was able to think of Christ not only as the creator of the cosmos, but also its caretaker. And so when he went to the pagans in Athens, he preached to them, and he told them that in God we move and we have our being. And so this is what we mean by a sacramental ontology.
In your article, and I mentioned this at the beginning, you state that some evangelicals, younger evangelicals, are leaving churches they grew up in and moving to more sacramental traditions like Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, or on the Protestant side, Anglican or Lutheran. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, there is some evidence that young evangelicals are now seeking out more liturgical churches that articulate this kind of sacramental outlook that I've been talking about. I say in the article that they're hungry for the sacred, but they're more hungry for other things too. They're hungry for community. They're hungry for tradition as opposed to individualism. They have become less concerned with the next big thing out there, the next fad. And so in the essay, when I say these millennials crave the weekly Eucharist over high-octane praise bands, they would rather observe Lent than attend a seeker-friendly service. I mean that they have a hunger for things sacramental and things traditional. I don't have any hard numbers on this. Some of it is anecdotal. But I do point to some sources in my essay. I also talk to professors at Christian colleges quite often, and they report that these trends are occurring among thoughtful, committed young people who have grown tired with next big thing churches. And so I have no comprehensive studies, no hard proof that this is happening en masse, but I think it is happening. I think Hank Hanegraaff's coming over to the Orthodox Church is more typical than we realize. I do have one study that I came across that I'll mention. It was a 2014 study conducted by Pew Research that the youngest denomination in the United States by age is the Orthodox Church. And it has a median age of 40 among its congregants. The oldest denomination by age, according to median age of its congregants, is the Presbyterian Church in America, with a median age of 59. So, although that's not a conclusive study, but it does show you that, at least this one particular study, that young people joining, say, an Orthodox Church is not, it's not uncommon.
Well, I would say, I mean, my particular communion is a Presbyterian church in America, and I would say that there are a lot of younger people, and there are some PCA churches that do serve communion weekly and, you know, have a more formal worship service. So I would say there's probably, I agree with you, maybe a reaction to the just general evangelical kind of mega church where it's, you know, I don't know,
yeah,
dry ice smoke coming out and, you know, just the hipster, you know, PowerPoints or what have you.
Sure.
But I do think that there are traditions because, you know, the roots of the tradition that I'm in goes all the way back, I mean, to like Scottish Puritanism and so forth,
yeah.
And European Puritanism. So I would say, while it might be true, I don't know what the stats are on my own communion in particular, I would say that, I don't know that, you know, I would say that maybe there's a movement going from particularly mass kind of consumption, shallow Christianity, but I wouldn't characterize my own communion in that fashion.
I do agree that, and I also come from a PCA church, although I attend an Anglican church now, but my son attends a PCA church, a large PCA church in Nashville. And it's interesting to me that they have started doing some things like observing the Lord's table every week, and then also reading from the Book of Common Prayer. And I've noticed over the last couple of years that their service has become more liturgical. So I think even though you might have young people who are leaving what we might think of as evangelical churches and going over to some of these more liturgical churches, I also see a trend, at least in observing churches that I'm aware of in the PCA, of churches becoming more liturgical and doing some things that are more traditional.
You talk about several famous Roman Catholic writers, in particular Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, and Flannery O'Connor. I love her work. What do they have to do with your thesis?
Well, both Tolkien and O'Connor believed that, and this is O'Connor's quote, that the holy lurks in creation. As you know, Tolkien utilized myth because he thought it was the best way to transcend truths that could be expressed in some type of intelligible and concrete form. In fact, he's noted for saying, "There is indeed no better medium for moral teaching than a good fairy story." And just as Tolkien knew that what he was doing when he imagined Middle Earth, Flannery O'Connor, I think, also knew what she was doing when she bold-stroked her characters into fiction. Like Tolkien, she was highly conscious of the sacramental power of language and even lectured on the subject in a number of essays that were published in Mystery and Manners, such as The Church and the Fiction Writer. She talks about this, and she says that fiction should be made according to nature, and when this occurs, it should reinforce our sense of the supernatural by grounding it in concrete, observable reality. Well, this is a sacramental viewpoint. She went on to say that if the writer uses his eyes in real security of his faith, he will be obliged to use them honestly, and his sense of mystery and acceptance of it will be increased. So both of these authors, Tolkien and O'Connor, had a sacramental outlook. I find it really interesting that many evangelicals love the writings of Tolkien and O'Connor, and I think connect very well with this sacramental view.
Now, you say that some observers are suggesting that the real divide in Christianity is no longer Protestant or non-Protestant like Eastern Orthodox or Roman Catholic, but rather progressive and historic. And, you know, obviously there are some major theological differences between, for example, Protestants and Roman Catholics. We, at CRI, we like to say that we're about mere Christianity, you know, the essentials of the Christian faith. So what do you mean by this? What do you mean about the real divide is more like progressive versus historic?
Yeah, of course, progressivism says that B is always an improvement over A that came before it. But this is really Enlightenment thinking, and I'm afraid that the modern church has bought into it. I mean, if you consider, say, mainline Protestant churches that have watered down or denied the doctrines of the faith, some of them now ordaining homosexuals to the ministry, and you think of what has happened over the last, say, 100 years within mainline Protestantism, and you think about it, and to some extent, I have more in common with my Roman Catholic brother or sister who recites the Nicene Creed every week than I do with some progressive Protestants.
That's very true. So at the end of the day, why does this particular topic matter? Why should we care about just the search of mystery and the sacred?
Well, if the progressives keep on progressing, they will progress right off the map of biblical truth. But I see more and more traditionalists finding common ground and working together. And if these trends continue, as I say in my article, the denominational planets will eventually realign, I'm thinking. I don't know for sure, but I can speculate that. So it's my opinion that the more traditionalists seek common ground, the more they're going to find themselves ending up maybe with something that St. Patrick and St. Augustine and St. Benedict would find familiar. Why does this matter? It matters because only a sacramental view of reality can ward off that increasing controlling materialism that C.S. Lewis warned us about 7 decades ago. So if we believe the created order is sacred, we will not rape it, we'll take care of it. If we believe marriage is sacred, we'll preserve it. If we believe life is sacred, then we will protect it.
Well, this has been a very thought-provoking conversation. So finally, I want to end with some fun, rapid-fire questions to ask Art. So the summer's kind of winding down, and some of our favorite foods will be going away. So corn on the cob or watermelon?
Corn on the cob. I had it last night with butter and salt, and it was delicious.
And would you rather do your taxes or have jury duty?
I would rather go to HR Block and do my taxes.
And are you spontaneous or are you more organized and planned?
The second, for sure.
And it's almost the end of the summer, as I said, so where did you go on vacation this summer?
Well, I just got back from a media ecology conference in California at St. Mary's College there in California. And we were talking about Marshall McLuhan, and I had a chance to talk a little bit with his son, Eric. So that really wasn't a vacation, but I did vacate a little bit. But my wife and I spent some time on the Gulf a couple of months ago.
Well, that sounds fun. Well, thanks, Art, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
All right. Thank you, Melanie.
Today's guest is Dr. Art Hunt, and in the volume 40, number 3, issue of the Christian Research Journal, Dr. Hunt has written a feature viewpoint article called In Search of the Sacred, Evangelicals on a Quest and Why It Matters. To read his article, please subscribe to the journal. Currently, our subscription is 6 issues and it's $39.50. And to subscribe online, visit equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Canegraff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you've liked this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities on iTunes, and we really need you to rate our podcast. And we'd like you to share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Canegraff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 1-888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and please subscribe to the new podcast called Hank Unplugged. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.